Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
So glad you've joined us with Here and Now Anytime, where we share stories that matter and stories that surprise. So go ahead, subscribe, follow, and share. Let's get started.
This port in Baltimore serves nearly 850,000 cars and light trucks a year. So this is a huge hit.
The economic impact of the Key Bridge collapse ripples across the Northeast Corridor. It's Wednesday, March 27th, 2024. From NPR and WBUR Boston, welcome to Here and Now Anytime. I'm Shirley Jihad. Today on the show, the U.S. Surgeon General has said it's a public health issue and that he believes 13 is too young to be on social media. And this week, Florida became the latest state to pass a law restricting kids' access to social media accounts. How can such laws be enforced, and will tech companies be on the hook for violations? And then, this one sounds like something out of a sci-fi thriller screenplay. A psychedelic drug made from an African root sends a user on a hellish, traumatic trip, visiting all of their life's past traumas. It can last 24 hours, and then poof! Some say addictions vanish. We'll explore how real this might be. First, right now, in Baltimore, investigators have found the black box data recorder on the massive cargo ship that smacked into the Key Bridge. Crews were searching for the bodies of six construction workers presumed dead after the bridge crumbled into the river. The Port of Baltimore may not reopen for months, and rebuilding the bridge may take years. Melody Simmons, senior reporter at the Baltimore Business Journal, gives Scott Tong an early look at the economic impact of the bridge collapse.
You know, every year the Port of Baltimore handles cargo that's worth a whopping $80 billion, which of course translates into port jobs, truck drivers, logistics contracts, on and on. Any early sense of what the economic impact might be of this port stoppage and the bridge collapse?
Scott, we're hearing that it could go up to $15 million a day on an impact to the state's economy. And I think this is why you see the governor, from the governor on down, heavily involved, very aggressively trying to get some resolution early on.
Yeah. Let me ask you about shortages and delays in the supply chain, things getting where they need to go. Does this mean scarcity equals prices going up? And we saw that in the pandemic.
Yes, we did see that in the pandemic. And everybody right now is being very cautious. They're saying it's too early to tell. But I have heard from some sources that they are expecting some price increases. This port in Baltimore serves nearly 850,000 cars and light trucks a year and did so last year. So this is a huge hit. Coming at this time. Baltimore is one of the few ports that has the roll-on, roll-off, possibility to get the cars on and off the boats themselves.
You mean they just kind of drive on and off the ship, making it very, very quick?
That's right.
Okay. And then there's packages, right? I mean, we take our packages for granted, but the highways going through Baltimore, I mean, they're key arteries for FedEx trucks, UPS, Amazon trucks. Have you had a chance to speak to local businesses in Baltimore about goods or deliveries being stuck right now?
Yes, I have. I've spoken to a lot of smaller businesses. One of them yesterday is Pompeian Olive Oil, and they have a huge import-export business for their olive oil based in Baltimore. They just expanded last year, and so they have a huge warehouse, and they were in total, reset mode yesterday, but everything seems to be so uncertain. This is what we're hearing from the businesses today, is that there's a lot of confusion and a lot of, just trying to pivot at this point. It's very difficult for them. They don't have enough data. They don't know what the trucking situation is going to be, the highway situation. The loss of that bridge alone to Pompeian is big, because their new warehouse is located probably about 3 or 4 miles from the bridge ramp.
Yeah. And, you know, just stepping back, I live about an hour from Baltimore, and many of us know it is a city that has struggled economically in the last generation. So many people have left the city. They've taken their tax revenue with them. What is the sense in the city of this next terrible hit to the city, to the communities?
There's a great sense of sadness, and I can tell you that this bridge was a beautiful local landmark. It was one of these structures that you could look out across the water from the Inner Harbor and see it. For many years, it was just served as a point of beauty. And, you know, the loss of the bridge, you know, it adds to the sense of uncertainty in the city, which has been struggling for so many years, as you said. There's a lot of attempt. There's a lot of grit and determination in Baltimore.
Yeah.
But sometimes things seem unsurmountable.
Hmm. Any early guesstimate before I let you go of when the port will be back up and running and when the key bridge might be rebuilt?
Well, as far as the bridge goes, it seems like it's years off. I spoke with an economist yesterday, and he told me that the best thing, if there is any silver lining to this, it would be that it will be a new bridge. It will be redesigned. It will be modern, and it will actually have more multimodal transportation options to it. Mm. So that's a good point, but we're years off. It's going to be in the billions. It has to be designed and engineered. And as far as the port reopening, mm-hmm. we have no idea. It's very uncertain. I think 30 days is, you know, very optimistic estimate. And I think we're looking, you know, more towards the, you know, early summer before they're able to get everything moved out of the way and cleared and get the port back up and running.
We've been talking to Melody Simmons, senior reporter at the Baltimore Business Journal. Melody, thanks for the time.
Thank you, Scott. Good talking to you.
Coming up next, we bar kids from buying alcohol until they're 18 or 21 years old. At what age should children be allowed to have social media accounts? More and more public health officials are raising concerns about links between social media and the mental health of young people. And this week, Florida became the latest state to pass a law centering on kids and social media. We'll hear more in a moment. Stay with us.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance. You call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. Tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options within your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR.
The NPR app cuts through the noise, bringing you local, national, and global coverage. No paywalls, no profits, no nonsense. Download it in your app store today.
Florida has a new law seeking to ban social media for children under 14. The governor, Ron DeSantis, signed the bill on Monday. His state joins California, Ohio, Arkansas, and other states trying to protect kids online. But many state laws have been blocked by judges. For some context, let's bring in Cristiano Lima Strong. He's a tech policy reporter at The Washington Post. Hi, Cristiano.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So first off, what is the general case for banning or limiting social media for teens? I read that the Surgeon General says wait till they're 14.
Right. So there's been a growing concern among policymakers that social media companies can potentially be addictive to kids, that the features that they're using and some of the ways that they are designed are keeping kids hooked and exposing them to harmful content. And that because of this, there need to be restrictions, either limiting their use or putting in parental guardrails or regulatory guardrails to try to ward off some of that harmful content or some of those negative experiences.
Yeah, which brings us to this new law in Florida. It is signed, begins next January 1st. The idea, as you describe, is to ban accounts for kids under 14. Though any parent knows there's a lot of faking of dates of birth going on. How would this be enforced?
Right. And the enforcement has been one of the key questions if this does come into force. The law sets up an age verification regime, basically requiring platforms to vet their users' ages and ensure that, you know, as you mentioned, kids under 14 are not able to create accounts and set up a presence on their sites. But there's been a lot of questions about this because age verification, while there's a lot of ways of doing this, a lot of them either might be easy for kids to circumvent, while some of the more efficient measures might require companies to collect a lot of data and potentially engage in some more invasive practices to make sure that they're who they're keeping out is indeed kids that policymakers say they're trying to protect.
Yeah. So the idea is, I guess, the apps, Instagram, TikTok, et cetera, they would be on the hook for penalties, again, if this law takes effect.
Yeah, so it's a bit unclear exactly which platforms this would apply to. The way that the definitions are set up is that it's platforms that kids that fall in this age range, if they spend a couple hours a day and they're a certain percentage of them are spending enough time on the platforms that they could be affected. It could also be if a platform is what the state considers to use an addictive design feature. I'm sure we'd see companies challenge whether this would indeed apply to them, but that's something down the road because, you know, we're also very likely to see challenges before this law even goes into effect, as you mentioned, in other states.
Right, right. So let's talk about the legal case companies are making against these laws. I gather the consistent pushback is that they, as the argument goes, violate users' free speech.
Yeah, so there's a couple arguments that they've been making. One is just as you've said, that you're limiting users' ability to engage in these communities, which, while policymakers have been, of course, focused on some of the harms, can have, you know, be beneficial for young people and provide an outlet for self-expression online. But then there's also this other bucket of concerns around the enforcement and the practicality, which is that to actually keep off kids, you have to figure out who kids are. And that's going to require companies who are constantly hearing that they're collecting too much data on users are going to need to collect even more to be able to make those determinations. And so that's the case that companies have been making, and to this point, quite successfully in court.
Cristiano, what about industry? I mean, many of us saw that congressional hearing in January when Meta's Mark Zuckerberg apologized to parents whose children's suicides were linked to social media. Are the apps putting any new rules or restrictions for younger users?
Yeah, so a lot of the companies, including Meta's products, have been doing things like trying to nudge users to spend less time on their sites. And try to limit some of the concerns around kids spending too much time on platforms. We've also seen platforms try to deal with this concern that the Florida law tries to tackle, which is give parents more control by setting up parental control centers that give parents more tools to sort of tailor their children's experience and supervise that on platforms. But part of what we've seen, and some of the reporting from my colleagues has shown, is that a lot of these tools are very seldomly used by parents who in surveys have said that they find them clunky and that it's very unwieldy to try to manage your kids' activity across the various apps and, you know, the vast internet. And so there's a lot of challenges as well in terms of what the companies are trying to do proactively to deal with some of these concerns.
We've been talking to Cristiano Lima Strong. He's tech policy reporter for the Washington Post's 202 newsletter. Cristiano, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, a psychedelic drug takes users on a day-long hell ride through the worst of their life's experiences. And then that might free them of addiction. Yeah, there are other possible side effects as well. The promise and the peril of Ibogaine. Stay with us.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor, Lisa, in collaboration with West Elm. Discover the new natural hybrid mattress, expertly crafted from natural latex and certified safe foams, designed with your health and the planet in mind. Visit leesa.com to learn more.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Federal researchers are now saying they're willing to allow new studies into Ibogaine nearly 40 years after regulators ended research into this powerful psychedelic that many scientists say can stop addictions on a dime. Ibogaine is made from an African root. One researcher says, though, you won't take it to end up in a cuddle puddle at a rave because it causes hellish trips up to 24 hours through past trauma. No one who takes it wants to do it again, but they may not have to. Research in other countries shows Ibogaine can end substance cravings after one treatment. But it can also cause cardiac arrest, which is why it's currently illegal in the U.S. New York Times psychedelic medicine reporter Andrew Jacobs has done extensive reporting into Ibogaine. And Andrew, it seems like there is a big resurgence of interest.
Yes, there's a great resurgence of interest, and that's partly because so many war veterans have gone to Mexico and other clinics out of the country to do Ibogaine therapy to treat PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and other difficult mental health issues. And at the same time, we're seeing a response to the opioid epidemic, and you have states like Kentucky and Ohio who have been considering spending some of the money they're getting from the opioid settlement of funds on Ibogaine research.
Well, and then many people have their own anecdotal evidence. Full disclosure, I have a friend who paid the $5,000 to $15,000 to go to Mexico to have a treatment. This was for alcoholism, which most people know that one treatment, one rehab, does not stop alcohol addiction. In this person's case, it did. But talk about the problems. Obviously, cardiac arrest, I think you say at least 24 deaths in the past decades.
Yeah, so I think those figures have to be taken with a grain of salt. There is no doubt a cardiac risk with Ibogaine. The issue that many researchers point out is a lot of opioid addicts, long-term opioid users, have severe underlying health issues, including cardiovascular issues. So that makes them especially susceptible. The other point that researchers have been making, backed up by research, is that you can mitigate those risks, first of all, by screening out patients who are at higher risk, but also by ensuring that those who are doing the therapy are hooked up to a heart monitor. And thirdly, giving patients magnesium both before and during the treatment. And that seems to effectively mitigate or address those risks. And the researchers that I talked to who've done many hundreds or thousands, in some cases, of treatments, they have had no fatalities.
Well, and also others are saying this is exactly why it needs to be researched by government agencies and then regulated. And you've got professionals who have been studying this. You spoke with Dr. Deborah Mash. We've spoken to her in the past as well. She's a professor of neurology at the University of Miami. She's been studying ibogaine since the early 1990s. If memory serves, some of her work she does in a boat offshore in Florida because it is illegal.
Yeah, so the clinic that she ran for many years was in the Caribbean, mostly served Americans. I think she had over 300 patients there and had no reported fatalities.
And says it's the most powerful addiction interrupter I've ever seen. Why? What is it said to do?
Well, it seems that ibogaine has two distinct modes of action. It really helps with the agony of withdrawal. It's very remarkable in that, to that extent. And then the other part is once people have come out of the treatment, it seems to head off the desire to use again.
And then you mentioned the veterans who have the traumatic brain injuries. It seems to do what? Rewire the brain? Something about neuroplasticity.
Right. So neuroplasticity is basically the ability of the brain to form new connections, new neurons, to sort of interrupt very looping thought patterns that you get stuck thinking about a trauma or thinking about something in your life that you can't get out of. And what this does is it allows you to get out of that loop and form new ways of seeing, for example, unresolved trauma in your past, and just gives you a way to kind of step outside it and understand how that trauma has perhaps informed your substance abuse. And the same with PTSD. It seems to get at that sort of the root trauma that is perhaps responsible for the psychological issues you're facing. People who have done it said it just really gives you perspective on that unresolved trauma.
And in so doing, changes your behavior. You talk about a small study that was published earlier this year in the journal Nature Medicine. Again, with military veterans with traumatic brain injuries, they underwent a single ibogaine therapy. Marked improvements in disability, psychiatric symptoms, cognition. Dr. Nolan Williams, who was the lead author and is also the director of the Brain Stimulation Lab at Stanford, said it's the most dramatic drug effect I've ever captured in an observational study. But that's not enough, an observational study. What's the impediment? What would agencies in the U.S. be able to do to take it further?
The gold standard is sort of your double-blind placebo trial. One group is getting the drug in question and one group is getting a placebo. And that is tough to do with psychedelics, you know, especially if you're expecting to have a hallucinogenic journey of some sort and you feel nothing. So that's part of the problem with studying these drugs. Not to say there's not a way around it, and which is all the more a reason these researchers are asking the FDA to allow studies to go forward in the future.
Well, but you mentioned this psychedelic journey. And it, from what I have heard from friends, it is a nightmare. I mean, you literally see things from your past that you might not have remembered. It's like a forced march through pain and trauma.
That's how it's been described by many people. Again, it's not the kind of psychedelic drug that you would want to go to a rave and do. Yeah, the accounts are really remarkably similar. There is this review, like you call it, this forced march through events of the past that some of which you may have forgotten, especially traumatic ones, and you're sort of forced to confront those memories. And it's very, very visual. But at the same time, when you've come through it, having that perspective of seeing that trauma from the sort of disembodied perspective suddenly gives you perspective on those torments.
During this trip, you sit with a doctor. You don't do this alone, but there are treatment centers in Mexico, in Brazil. What do we know about their claims and their research into their success?
So the clinic in Brazil, it's not a clinic that Americans can go to. It's for Brazilians, and it's largely focused on crack cocaine addiction. But the doctor there, Bruno Rasmussen, has been doing that for many years, and I think over 1,000 patients. He has a, quote, cure rate, I'll put it that way, of over 70%. After one session. And he too has not reported any fatalities. And he's got pretty good data to back that up. The clinics in Mexico, which are privately run, a lot of those are now partnering with researchers in the US and starting to sort of get data out of those clinics. But again, I think what we need in the U.S. here is sort of an FDA regulatory approach.
And by the way, in the early 90s, during the crack epidemic here, there were promising animal studies. The FDA approved human trials. What happened?
Yeah, in the 1990s, the FDA was studying ibogaine for crack addiction. And despite what seemed to be promising results at the time, they pulled the plug after a report surfaced of fatalities linked to the cardiac risks of the drug.
And by the way, you don't just go and have some cocktails while you're going to get this magic pill. I mean, as we've said, the treatment itself is just horrendous from what we can understand. And then there's protocol in Brazil, for instance, there's mandatory PrEP. You have to abstain from drugs for a couple of weeks. There's counseling before and after. This is not a breeze.
No, and it's not a recreational experience. And it's something that you have to be very mindful going in. It's a therapy. It's not just of dropping a drug and expecting a cure. You have to go in with the intention of wanting to deal with some issue, and you have to adhere to all the requirements. And I think that's what people might misunderstand about it. It's not a miracle drug that you just take a pill and you're fine. You have to really work at it. It's a tool.
Although you quote people who have done it who believe it is a miracle because they come out of it on the other side with absolutely no cravings. But I wonder too, obviously there are questions about can people's hearts and physical being sustain this, but going through that kind of an emotional terror and you can't get out of it while you're in the middle of a trip, is there concern? Have there been people who harm themselves because they're overwhelmed by the emotion?
I have not heard about that, and I'll tell you why. These therapies are done in a medical setting. The ones that are recommended, the ones that are not fly-by-night, you're never alone. You're being monitored the entire time to help you through those difficult moments, and you're also prepared. You've also done preparation. You have a certain sense of what to expect. Not to say it's easy, but I think, you know, going back to your earlier point, you have to want to get better. You know, you have to want this. So in that sense, it's not a miracle. The people who've described it as a miraculous are people who were desperate to kick this disorder.
Many of them opioid addicts, and many people are pushing hard for the government to study the possibility of ibogaine. You quote Henry Lucas, the chief operating officer of the Kentucky Harm Reduction Coalition. He's in recovery from opioid dependence, and he says, we got to try something. Because we're desperate.
I mean, that's the thing. You know, the argument that this is too dangerous to study, I think, also overlooks the fact that the people that we're talking about, the alternative is pretty grim. You know, many of them will die anyway, most likely from a fentanyl overdose of some kind. And the other thing to keep in mind is many interventions, medical interventions, have risks associated with them. And what these experts say is, you know, we learn to manage those risks, and that's how we should approach ibogaine and not write it off as an off-limits drug just because it has a real clear cardiac risk. They say it is manageable, and that's how we should approach this drug.
That's New York Times psychedelic medicine reporter Andrew Jacobs, who's devoted his work to psychedelic drugs like ibogaine. Andrew, thank you so much, and we will stay tuned. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Our podcast today comes to you thanks to the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories are produced by Lynn Menigan, Kalyani Saxena, and Karen Miller-Medson. Our editors are Todd Munt, Micaela Rodriguez, Peter O'Dowd, Michael Scotto, and Kat Welch. Technical directors are Mike Moschetto, Caleb Green, and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and Chris Bentley created the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. I'm Shirley Jihad. Thank you for being with us, and be sure to subscribe. See you tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Grammarly, the secure AI writing partner that understands your business. With Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.